This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and editors about politics. It's Thursday, June 23rd. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. Yesterday, Democratic members of Congress staged a sit-in to try to force a vote on gun control. House Speaker Paul Ryan tried to bring the House to order.
The chair wishes to make an announcement regarding the decorum in the House chamber. The chair appreciates that members will differ on matters of policy and will seek to express those differences. But the chair would hope that the business of the House could be conducted in a fashion that respects positively on the dignity and the decorum of this institution to which we all belong.
Evan Osnos joins me to discuss the possibly changing politics of guns as we enter the general election campaign. Evan, welcome.
Hi, Dorothy.
Sometimes Congress surprises us. So that was kind of an amazing spectacle yesterday, led by the civil rights leader John Lewis, after Congress voted down four modest gun control bills, and they were introduced after the largest massacre by a gunman in U.S. history. So it was great theater, but does it mark any kind of departure from the status quo?
I think it's important, not only because it's, even by the standards of, you know, Congress in the last few years, quite a remarkable sign. It really is a reflection of the fact that you have members of Congress today, most of them obviously Democrats, but also some Republicans who are outraged and, more importantly, I think, embarrassed. I mean, when you talk to them about it, they are embarrassed about the fact that in the midst of this serial trauma to the American public associated with these mass shootings, that they have really been incapable of doing anything. That has finally come to a head, and it doesn't immediately produce changes in the law, but it's the kind of moment that it has a signaling effect. It tells members of Congress that this issue is not simply going to disappear, and it also tells the American public that there is an appetite among some members of Congress to try to do something about it.
The public really appears to strongly back measures like the ones proposed this week requiring background checks. You know, really kind of straightforward, simple
right.
things. We know about the power of the NRA, but members of Congress, they also have to pay some attention to their constituents. So why do these bills get voted down again and again and again?
Well, this is a reflection of this intensely polarized environment, obviously, around guns. But there's a detail that I think is often lost when we talk about the public polling and the mood on guns. People tend to support really specific legislative solutions to gun violence. So, for instance, expanding background checks is supported by, depending on the poll, about 90% of the public. And even among NRA members, there is a sign that support is overwhelming. But when you step back from those specific proposals and you ask people generally about gun control versus gun rights, you have found a trend in the opposite direction. So over the last few years, the general public has actually become more accommodating to the abstract idea of gun ownership. That didn't used to be the case. And what I think that reflects is that there has been, particularly among Republican rank and file, the sort of cumulative effect of this long-term and very targeted, very focused effort on the part of the NRA and its allies in Congress to remind people, persuade them, in effect, that really guns are essential to their public safety. And so people are both desperate for some kind of change that would try to bring an end to this gun violence, but at the same time, they don't have much faith that the government itself is going to be able to do it. And so they are, for lack of a better word, they are arming themselves to try to keep themselves safe.
It's really astonishing. And this gets at the heart of the piece you just wrote for the magazine, the theme of which was not only how effective the gun lobby has been in cultivating fear among Americans, but how gun manufacturers have played that up, too. And I just want to play a quick clip from Donald Trump, who happens to be packing his bags for a trip to his golf resort in Scotland right now. But last week, after those shootings at the Orlando nightclub, he had this to say.
If some of those wonderful people had guns strapped right here, right to their waist or right to their ankle, and one of the people in that room happened to have it and goes boom, boom, you know what? That would have been a beautiful, beautiful sight, folks.
Evan, tell us about that and what you found when you did the reporting for your piece.
Well, Donald Trump in that message, and he's made similar comments after attacks in San Bernardino, for instance, and in Paris last year, he's picking up on what has become the central motto of the modern gun rights movement. And that is the idea, as expressed by Wayne LaPierre, head of the NRA, that the only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. If you think about that concept, it's really quite extraordinary. What it's saying is that the answer to guns is more guns. And this is a new chapter, really, in the history of the NRA. This concept took hold after the attack on Sandy Hook Elementary School in 2012. What you find is that this message is a perfect fit for what the gun industry actually needs for its own business reasons. For years, the gun industry was driven by hunting. But hunting has been in decline now for 40 years in America. And they realized that at a certain point, they had to figure out how they were going to replace that market. And the answer was that they created, in effect, and cultivated a new market for self-defense guns. And today, the primary source of revenue and profit in the gun industry is self-defense. And self-defense, after all, is expressed in the NRA's idea that the only way that you're going to stop this bad guy with a gun is if you yourself have a gun.
So talk about that in terms of the conceal and carry laws we've seen.
The biggest change in the law and the culture and really the business of guns over the last generation has been something that we don't often talk about. It's almost by design a kind of discrete revolution, and that's the advent of what's known as concealed carry. That's the legal right to be able to carry a hidden gun on your person when you leave the house. 2 decades ago, 22 states either banned or strictly regulated the ability to leave your house with a gun concealed. Today, it's now legal in all 50 states. This has been the result of a systematic and quite effective effort on the part of NRA lobbyists and their allies to try to expand that right state by state. As a result, now, today, there are 12.8 million people who have concealed carry permits. And to put that in perspective, that's more than 12 times the number of police officers and detectives in America. I mean, for most of American history, even advocates of gun rights did not advocate that you should be able to go out of your house with a gun.
Not to mention walking into churches and schools and other public places with guns.
Yeah, there has been, in addition to sort of expanding the fundamental right, what they call the right to carry, there has also been these targeted laws that are designed to break down specific barriers. So, for instance, now in a number of states, it's legal to carry a gun in a bar. It's legal to carry it at a daycare center and certainly in church. And this fall, Texas will become the 8th state to allow students, for instance, to carry guns on campus. For a lot of Americans, we're now sort of waking up to this fact that there are walking among us every day when we're in line at the bank or you're sitting in the food court at the mall. There are guns around in ways that we weren't even really aware of a few years ago. And I think that's one of the reasons why the politics of guns are now bursting into the open in more visible ways than we've seen in a few years.
Evan, you would think there would be a market at least for smart guns. Why is there not?
The NRA and the gun industry have been fiercely opposed to smart guns for a long time, for two reasons. One is mechanical and one's political. The mechanical reason is they say, well, these things might not work in a pinch. But two, and I think this is probably the much larger reason, the NRA tells its members that smart guns would be the beginning of a slippery slope that would eventually lead to seizures of non-smart guns. And that message has been very effective. When companies have tried to come out with a smart gun, as Smith & Wesson did 15 years ago, they were boycotted. Their stock lost most of its value over the course of a year. The CEO was fired, and eventually the company was sold. The CEO of Smith & Wesson has said recently, we will never forget that mistake, and we won't make that mistake again, as he puts it. But at the same time, there is this new generation of entrepreneurs who sense that there is a market out there for smart guns. Despite the opposition of the NRA, you may find that in a few years, these kinds of smart guns are available for sale in America.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
Just to get back for a second to what was going on this week in Congress, Senator Susan Collins, who is a Republican, proposed a compromise on terrorist watch list measures. Just the idea of that is startling, that we need to have a compromise on such a thing. Could you explain what that is all about?
Collins is trying to bridge this gap, which, oddly enough, both sides agree is ridiculous. You know, we are now just a couple of weeks after the most devastating mass shooting in American history, in which somebody who had been on a terrorist watch list, had been investigated by the FBI, was able to buy guns and then go on to commit violence. And for Republicans who care about terrorism and for Democrats who care about gun violence, this has been such an offensive example of the inability of Congress to do something. You had four bills that were introduced that would have prevented people from the terrorist watch list from being able to buy guns. It would have also expanded the background check and toughened the background check system. And all four of those bills failed. And so Susan Collins is trying to take, in a sense, a much more limited version of the ban on people who were on the terrorist watch list. She's using a smaller list, in effect, that is also produced by government agencies around people of concern. And at last check, this may change, but it's probably not headed for success. So even this really limited attempt, almost a symbolic effort to try to give Americans some sense that Congress is responding and even acknowledging the horror in Orlando, is stumbling. So what I think is that you're beginning to see that Congress is so frozen, so locked into these positions, that it's going to be very difficult for that body to do anything at all.
So let's talk about the courts. We've talked about the impossibility on the legislative level. The Supreme Court decided this week not to review a challenge to the ban in Connecticut against AR-15 assault weapons. How significant is that decision?
It's meaningful because by choosing not to intervene, this extends what has been a recent trend by the Supreme Court to allow lower courts to decide essentially for their own people what the gun laws are going to be. So that means that in California and some of the Western states, there will be different gun laws than there are in the South. And this is a reflection of how deeply polarized the gun issue has become. The most important Supreme Court decision on guns came in 2008. That was in District of Columbia versus Heller, in which the court enshrined the individual right to self-defense within the home. But since then, the court has been fairly reluctant to get involved in this issue. What they've done is they have deferred, in a sense, to these regional attitudes, where if you live in Vermont that has very, very relaxed gun laws, you're going to have a completely different experience with guns than if you live in California.
Tell us a little bit about the pressure from Bloomberg, who started his own group to put pressure on the gun industry and the gun lobby. How effective has that been?
This is a big change in the politics of guns, because there was the attack at Sandy Hook Elementary that was, I think, for a lot of people, the sort of final moment of frustration. They said, if the United States cannot muster a meaningful response to the slaughter of 20 children in their school and six of their teachers and administrators, then really our politics are broken. And Michael Bloomberg at that point promised to invest tens of millions of dollars in trying to achieve some sort of legislative response. And since then, you have seen something important change in this frozen conflict. For years, the NRA had a monopoly on passion, basically. The people who supported gun rights had much more invested personally. They were much more mobilized politically. They would go to the polls. They would call their lawmakers. And people on the other side, it really wasn't something that people voted on. Mike Bloomberg has set out to try to change that. And he and a number of other organizations have become much more effective at two things. One is mobilizing people to put pressure on the federal government. So, for instance, this past week, the Brady campaign against gun violence, they mobilized, by their count, about 150,000 calls to members of Congress to try to force this issue to a head. And At the same time, they've been going to the states. In some ways, they are borrowing a strategy from the effort to achieve the legalization of gay marriage. They said this was too polarized in Congress, so let's go to the states and see what we can get done. And they've actually had some modest successes. Some of this is that they've prevented laws that would have relaxed gun laws. And in other cases, they've been able to achieve some minor uptick in scrutiny and restriction on gun rights. But I think the introduction of Mayor Bloomberg's money and organization and a few groups that are allied with him has started to change the political chemistry around guns.
If Hillary Clinton is elected, what kinds of changes might we see?
I think there are a couple of very important things that are on the line in the presidential election as it relates to guns. Number one, after all, is the Supreme Court. Hillary Clinton has said that she thinks that the court made a mistake when it ruled that there was this individual right to self-defense. This is a big change from just a few years ago. You remember in 2008 that Hillary talked about her own experience hunting. She talked about the fact that her father had taken her out to go and learn how to use a gun. And this year, she's not doing any of that. She now talks about her failing grades from the NRA. She advertises the fact that she is deeply opposed to what the NRA and its allies have done. All of the data that the Clinton campaign has accumulated is telling them that the public is ready, in effect. Certainly Democrats are ready for a more confrontational position against the NRA. Also, it's worth pointing out that when you talk to people in the Obama White House, as I did recently, I spoke to Valerie Jarrett, who has been in charge of a number of these gun initiatives. She says, quite openly, this is the single greatest frustration that the president and his staff have, which is the inability, despite all of these mass shootings over the course of the last 7.5 years, to do anything really substantial. I think it's also worth saying, if there is a Trump administration, he will bring into office the most fervent pro-gun position that we've ever seen from a nominee. He supports a national right to concealed carry. He's wavered on this a little bit, but he supports an end to the gun-free zones in schools. And I think even beneath that, he brings with him a kind of celebration of aggression, as he talks about very openly. He believes that this is a world in which we are beset by enemies and we have to be constantly alert to the risks around us. That's a message that you hear when you go to the NRA convention, as I did last month. I think if he, in fact, does make it to the White House, you will find an attitude towards guns that we haven't seen before.
Okay, thank you so much, Evan.
Thanks, Dorothy.
Evan Osnos is a staff writer covering the presidential campaign and the author of Age of Ambition, Chasing Fortune, Truth, and Faith in the New China. This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. You can find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com or on the New Yorker apps, available at no extra charge from the App Store and Google Play. And you can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app. The Political Scene is produced by Alex Barron and Jill Duboff for NewYorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.